Abdelmalek met the UN representative, Mr. Martin Griffith, last Sunday, and he warned him against continuing to exploit the humanitarian issues of the people, and he affirmed that this will not get them any gains, political gains. And he said that if they continue this, it only means that they are not serious about bringing back peace to Yemen or ending their war.
Well, in the meantime, the Yemeni armed forces are making great advances in the northern governorate of Ma'rib, while also simultaneously achieving groundbreaking reconciliation with many Yemeni tribes in that governorate, which means that less fighting is ahead, which means more reconciliation is to be viewed in the future. How significant do you think the liberation of Ma'rib will be in changing the balance of power in this ongoing Saudi onslaught of Yemen?
It's very important. The liberation of Ma'rib can significantly alter the whole political terrain, and most probably will determine the subsequent outcomes for years to come. The governorate is oil-rich, and it has been used as a stronghold by the coalition for their military operations for the past 6-7 years. Losing it means losing a major source of finance. It also means that the forces that are there will be outcasted. There are several mix of mercenary groups that are fighting alongside the coalition, including Al-Qaeda. And if they are outcasted from Ma'rib, they will not have an alternative place to be in. If they go towards the south, they are not welcomed. And that will further complicate the problems that the coalition is already facing with its different factions there.
What would you think that a liberation of Ma'rib would actually complicate the dialogue, the peace process in Yemen?
No, actually it will foster it, I think, because they are trying to protect Ma'rib with every level of strength that they have. I think it will be a very good gain, because they will not have any more strong points to negotiate on.
Well, the very important issue in this negotiation that is to be taking place, if it is already taking place, is the humanitarian status inside of Yemen. As you mentioned before, there are more than 13 million civilians in Yemen on the verge of complete starvation. What do you think will be the biggest challenge for Ansarullah in the event of a ceasefire?
In the event of a ceasefire, there will be a challenge of inclusion. Let's say the goal would be to include all the political parties and resume the peace process again. Mm-hmm. It is that peace process, if you remember, before this military intervention by Saudi, that was going under UN supervision, and almost the previous UN representative Jamal bin Omar said Yemenis were about to reach a historical consensus, a peaceful agreement, when this military action started on March 2015. So if they stop their aggression, I think it would be less of a challenge to resume that peace process and include everybody, but in terms of level terms, not with domination coming from Saudi or the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Shami, political commentator, who joined us from Sana'a to talk about the prospects of talks, negotiations, and complete cessation of a war against Yemen, and also the inclusion of Yemen in the Al-Quds versus a regional war equation set up by the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Shami, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz.
The Saudis waged the Yemen war during the Democratic administration of Obama. The war actually began with the US's green light. The U.S. sanctioned the war and helped the Saudis. They gave the Saudis numerous military resources. To what end? In order to make the people of Yemen surrender in the course of 15 days? 1 month? After having dropped so many bombs on them? Well, they made a mistake. They have not managed to do it in the past 6 years. The war against Yemen began on such a day. 6 years have passed from that day, but they have not managed to force the Yemenis to surrender. I wish to put this question to the Americans. The day when you gave the Saudis the green light to enter into the Yemen war, did you know in what quagmire the Saudis would get stuck? You knew into what quagmire you were dragging the Saudis, as in the present time. They can neither stay nor leave.
Subhanallah,
has two facets for the Saudis in the present time. They can neither stop the war nor continue it. Both options of the issue are detrimental to them. Did you Americans know what disaster you were creating for the Saudis? If you knew it and you did it anyway, then how poor your allies are, because you treat them like that. And if you did not know it, then again how poor your allies are for trusting you and for coordinating their plans with you, who are not familiar with regional issues. Therefore, you should know that you do not know the region and regional nations, and that you are making a mistake. I hope that Allah the Exalted guides all the ignorant in the world out of their ignorance and makes them turn back from their mistakes. I hope that Allah the Exalted will make the Iranian nation dearer and more powerful on a daily basis, that He will help them benefit from the comforts of life more than ever, and that He will render them happy and blissful. I hope that God will improve their worldly and otherworldly conditions. I hope that the holy heart of the Imam of the age will be satisfied with the people of Iran, and that all our people, including this humble person, will benefit from the prayers of that great Imam. I hope that the immaculate soul of our magnanimous Imam and the pure souls of martyrs will be satisfied and pleased with us. Greeting be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
The world with reporters.
Roughly 1 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccines arrived in South Korea from the United States earlier this week. More Americans have been vaccinated than people in any other country, and the U.S. is now sharing, suggesting no strings are attached, with exceptions and flexibility.
The United States is not asking anything of any country to whom we're giving doses. We're not seeking to extract concessions. We're not extorting. Korea's situation is unique. As the president said when President Moon visited, the animating purpose behind that is actually about the protection of American forces and the forces who serve alongside American forces, the Korean troops who are standing shoulder to shoulder with us in that country.
The World Health Organization and infectious disease experts have criticized wealthy countries for hoarding vaccines, vaccine nationalism, even calling it vaccine apartheid. Experts say the U.S. gift to South Korea had various motives. The U.S. has restricted the use of its vaccine supply for South Korea to Korean soldiers that work alongside the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in the country. U.S. efforts to contain China accelerated back in 2007 with the creation of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue involving Japan, Australia, India, and the United States. South Korea has been reluctant to join the grouping as it does not want to offend its main trading partner, China, which has condemned the Quad for targeting Beijing. South Korean President Moon Jae-in secured the vaccines during a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden in late May, as Seoul struggles to balance its alliance with the United States and growing trade with China. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, says it's still not clear whether the U.S. is ready to abandon what he calls an addiction to imposing sanctions on Iran. Addressing the IAEA's Board of Governors, Gharibabadi said Iran is in favor of continuing negotiations aimed at reviving the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, but that it would only go back to full compliance after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions.
The ball is actually in the court of the United States. They have to take very difficult decisions, and political one, of course, whether they are ready to put aside this policy of addiction to the sanctions or not, and whether they are ready to comply their own commitments under the JCPOA and also the other international obligations.
The Iranian envoy said Tehran is also seeking assurances that the U.S. would not withdraw from the deal again or abuse any mechanism within the JCPOA to reimpose sanctions. On Monday, the Board of Governors heard concerns about Iran's past nuclear activities from Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi. Grossi said there was a lack of progress in talks with Iran about the presence of uranium particles found in undeclared locations in the country. Ghali Bawadi responded by saying the agency is aggrandizing trivial issues that do not pose any proliferation risk and are not urgent. Instead, he argued, the agency should focus on the nuclear weapons program of Israel that's shunned all arms control and non-proliferation treaties.
I recommended the agency to put aside this political approach and not to convert this organization, not to turn this organization into a political organization. The IAEA should remain technical and professional.
As discussions on Iran come to an end at the IAEA, nuclear negotiators are expected to gather at Vienna's Grand Hotel for another round of talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA. Homolesky, Vienna.
After a raucous first debate, the second presidential showdown was quiet, where candidates focused on laying out their agenda and maintained a respectful tone, even when criticizing each other. With social affairs taking central stage, the debate tested the contenders' capability to address the country's social issues, such as health, education, and poverty.
Currently, there are some 7 million heads of household in our country that depend on charities to make ends meet. We need to set up a fund that ensures a sustainable income for these people.
To fight corruption, we need to fight unfair wealth distribution. We need to pay equal attention to the less privileged stratum of society.
If I am elected president, I will make changes to the circulars that allow astronomical salaries for certain managers. This way, we can help promote justice.
While the three-hour debate focused on social issues, journalists who waited outside the debate studio had other questions to ask, as the candidates got out one by one for a brief Q&A session. I was curious to know how each of the candidates would address regional issues, both politically and economically.
We are seriously pursuing close ties with our neighbors. Our region offers a 500 million strong market to us, but with regards to security issues, I have always stressed that the measures taken by late General Qasem Soleimani have turned Iran into a regional power. We have acted very well in the military field and diplomacy. But what's important is to build a bridge through the military field and diplomacy to expand our economic ties with our neighbors.
As oil-rich Iran is exploring ways to reduce dependence on the fluctuating oil market, this topic was among the FAQs, with journalists asking the candidates about what alternative economic engines they would employ to run the economy.
I will turn Iran into a food hub in the region. To this end, we will need more water and farmlands. We can expand our agricultural cooperation with other countries, especially those in Africa, which has so far been neglected.
To maintain impartiality, the national television, also known as the IRIB, has arranged every step of the debate based on a lottery system, from the order of the candidates' entrance to the IRIB to the questions posed to them, and even their seats, are determined randomly. Candidates will face off for the last time on Saturday in the third debate. This time, the content of what the candidate said might be what the Iranian public remembers from the debate. Now the seven rivals have one more chance to stand out and woo more public support in the third and final debate, slated for June 12. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
To find a solution to the years-long war on Yemen, an Omani delegation has visited Sana'a and held talks with the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, and the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council. During the talks, Houthi hailed Oman for its efforts and stance beside Yemenis since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The Omani delegation is exerting efforts, but its success is possible when the Saudi-led coalition admits it's failed in Yemen. However, it seems Saudi Arabia is still trying to impose pressure on Sana'a by tightening the siege to gain what it has failed to achieve in the war. We appreciate what our Omani brothers are doing and hope that they will succeed in ending the suffering of our people.
Observers say there's good progress in the humanitarian situation and Sana'a Airport might be reopened soon, as well as Hodeidah Port, which means that the fuel ships will be allowed to enter the country. They believe that the success of Oman's delegation will relieve the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
There's a keenness by Sana'a's leadership for the Saudi-led coalition to start taking steps to prove its good intentions to end the aggression. The first of these steps is to complete the humanitarian agreement, open Sana'a's airport and Hodeidah port, and allow the entry of oil ships. After that, other issues will be agreed upon, and this will build trust between the two parties. And the Omani delegation seems to be succeeding in that.
To meet the political leadership and discuss the possible ways to lift the siege imposed on Yemenis by Saudi Arabia. Since the beginning of 2015, the Saudi war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis believe that the Omani delegation is finally succeeding in removing all impediments to their access to food and fuel. They say lifting the blockade is the first real step toward a nationwide ceasefire and the end of the brutal war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Since the turmoil of Brexit, the UK's Conservative government has splurged billions of dollars on expensive military projects, with plans to spend hundreds of billions more to project Britain's military might internationally. But while it's loosened the purse strings of military spending, the British government has tightened them on the country's underfunded public health system and on foreign aid, where it used to lead the way. The $5.5 billion cut will mean less relief for war-torn Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UN Secretary General has called the move a death sentence. The cuts also affect aid to the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, and other life-saving projects in countries such as Syria, Ethiopia, and Afghanistan. Hundreds of charities, academics, and business leaders have signed a letter warning the government the cuts cast a shadow over the nation's role at the G7 and risk undermining its credibility on the world stage.
The amount of weapons that we are selling to be dropped on the head of the Yemenis on one side, and on the other side denying them any sort of support or cutting down those support, it really is outrageous, unacceptable.
The British government says its decision to slash foreign aid was a response to the economic shock brought on by the pandemic, meaning perhaps that once the health crisis blows over, foreign aid will go back to previous levels.
Despite the pandemic, government aid designed to promote the economic development and welfare of developing countries rose to an all-time high last year, with the largest contributions coming from the U.S., followed by Germany. Britain took third place.
There is a fraction within the sort of extreme right who always wanted to cut our contribution to these countries, and they never believed in helping, giving a helping hand. And I think this is an excuse. Right now, it's an excuse to actually give in to those section of the Conservative Party.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a rebellion at home from MPs, including his predecessor, Theresa May, pushing the government to reconsider. Theirs and a growing number of other voices are urging Britain to be the world leader it claims to be. Saeed Puriza, London.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's Board of Governors, convenes a week-long meeting to discuss monitoring and verification in Iran, among other issues. Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi expressed concern over a lack of progress in discussions about the presence of nuclear material in four undeclared locations in Iran.
The Iranian government has reiterated its will to engage and to cooperate and to provide answers, but they haven't done that so far. So I hope this may change, but as we speak, we haven't had any concrete progress on any of the issues.
Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says he's asked the agency not to use some unimportant issues dating to around two decades ago
as an excuse to politicize Iran's case at a time when negotiations are underway to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known as the JCPOA. Grossi acknowledged there's nothing that indicates there is a danger when it comes to the safeguards-related issues, but stressed that the agency would not stop asking questions. In his latest report, Grossi also said the agency's access to Iranian nuclear facilities has been restricted since the 23rd of February as a result of a parliamentary law that obliges the government to go ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities and to deny the agency broader or complementary access beyond the country's regular safeguards obligations. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the agency, valid until the 24th of June, the IAEA will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Grossi said an extension of that agreement was becoming increasingly difficult. Iran says it will transfer all the collected data to the agency and return to full compliance with the JCPOA after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions. Omar Lizgi, Vienna.
With more than a week left to the upcoming presidential election in Iran, the rivalry gets tighter. After a showdown between the candidates in the first debate, now they continue their campaigns on social media and national television. As the raucous debate revealed little information about the candidates' future plans, reporters try to extract more details through briefing sessions.
If we want to take strides in job creation, we need to pull the plug on sales of raw material. On top of them is crude oil. If one oil barrel gets us $50, its petrochemical products get us an added value of up to $2,000.
The upstream and downstream oil sectors have the potential to generate 880,000 jobs, but unfortunately, 25% of the petrochemical sector is not tapped into. If we operate this unused part, we can save $5 billion in petrochemical imports, and at the same time, we would generate thousands of jobs.
During his two terms as Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani did a lot with regards to foreign policy, clinching the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, while retaining the country's intimate ties with its eastern partners, namely China and Russia. Now, as the Atomic Accord is facing a bumpy road ahead, most of the candidates believe it's not the master key for fixing Iran's economy.
The removal of sanctions isn't tied to negotiations with the U.S. We can instead neutralize the effect of the sanctions by tapping into myriad of resources in our country, such as rich mineral reserves.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. The second and third debates are scheduled for Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will be themed with cultural and political issues. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th.
Well, the first debate was more pugnacious and less informative. It did not give a clear image of each of the candidates' policies. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the failure of Moscow talks, an Omani delegation along with the Yemeni negotiating delegation has arrived at Sana'a Airport as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen. Mohammed Abdusalam, who headed the Yemeni delegation at the talks, said the meeting was aimed at pushing up the humanitarian situation that has been deteriorating due to the all-out blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
The talks are held to discuss the overall situation in Yemen, including the peace talks and the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Oman has always served as an arena for all Yemenis in political affairs, and today we are going to complete the efforts we made in Oman during the past months.
Observers say this move could make a difference in the political process, as Oman has always been beside Yemenis and realizes the circumstances of Yemen.
The Omani delegation is welcomed in our country because Oman has always been a good neighbor. We hope Oman could help us remove the current humanitarian crisis. We must have this point in mind that if the U.S. continues to link the humanitarian crisis in Yemen to the military realities on the ground, no progress would be made. Therefore, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen should be top on agenda.
The latest round of negotiations in Oman's capital, Muscat, failed to find a solution to the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. According to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen has killed almost a quarter of a million Yemenis, caused outbreaks of disease, turned Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and brought the poor Arab country to the verge of famine.
Yemenis are optimistic about the Omani delegation visit to their country, saying Omani is capable of achieving what the UN envoy has failed during the past years and putting an end to the suffering of the war-ravaged nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As India continues to battle the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, the destitute Rohingya community fights it all alone. The community is not eligible to apply for vaccine since they are described as illegal immigrants. Rights activists say they are in desperate need of help as the virus has started raging across the camps.
First they started the deportation drive, then detention, and now the lockdowns. Why are all miseries for us? Why is the world silent? Don't we have the right to live? We have no work due to lockdowns, and now this virus is frightening us since we can't get access to any healthcare services here.
The COVID-19 pandemic has brought more miseries to the community, since most of them used to work in the unorganized sector. Now, due to lockdowns, most of them have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity, while hunger and poverty looms over the community. The refugee camps are cramped, and the spread of virus is inevitable, they say, since their makeshift shanties lean on each other with no sanitation, food support, or health care, since they are not included in the government support programs. Most of them work as daily wage workers or scrap collectors to make a living, but the government restrictions and lockdown has left many out of work.
Some locals and NGOs are helping us with food and other essentials in these dire times. We, however, urge the UN Refugee Agency to play their part. We don't need just guidelines. We need access to vaccination.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different Indian states.
In recent weeks, many of these refugees, including children, had developed COVID-like symptoms. But due to lack of testing facilities and shortage of vaccine, they're on their own. Most of them have resorted to home remedies and self-quarantine. Many, however, fear if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine, a humanitarian disaster awaits their community. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Limelight. As anyone who has experienced middle age will know, the process of growing old can be extremely hard on the body. Your bones begin to leak calcium, your muscles begin to shrivel, the immune system weakens, and arthritis can set in. Poor posture and balance affect how you move about the world, while cataracts and deteriorating eyesight impair how you see it. Heart problems and declining cognitive function eventually set in as people approach the end of their lives. These symptoms, however, can also be caused by something less common: space travel. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Shi and Kim, a commentator and writer, under the heading "To Study Aging, Scientists Are Looking to Outer Space." Spaceflight influences biology in dramatic ways, and people in space appear to experience the effects of aging faster than people on Earth. Now scientists have gained a better understanding of space travel's influence on living beings than ever before. A slew of 29 papers recently published in the journals Cell, Cell Reports, iScience, Cell Systems, and Patterns examined the biological hazards of spaceflight in 56 astronauts. More than 10% of all the people who have ever been to space. The new studies bring us a step closer to identifying the mechanisms underpinning the biological responses to living in space. More than 200 scientists demonstrated that space upends the genes, mitochondrial function, and chemical balances in the cells to trigger a cascade of broader health effects in spacefaring humans and animals. Susan Bailey, a radiologist at Colorado State University who participated in multiple of the new studies, says the entire body is affected because space is such a different and extreme environment. The health effects associated with spaceflight have several similarities to aging, to aging-related disorders such as cancer and osteoporosis. While spaceflight's parallels to aging are a concern for long-term crewed missions, such as those that would be required on a voyage to Mars, The unique space environment also presents a unique opportunity to study the physiology of aging. It's estimated that the heart, blood vessels, bones and muscles deteriorate more than 10 times faster in space than by natural aging. This means to study the aging process, scientists don't have to wait for their biological subjects to naturally mature on Earth. They can harness the accelerated health effects by running experiments on the International Space Station, the ISS. Scientists stress that the symptoms of space travel aren't exactly the same as aging, and many changes reverse themselves once people return to Earth. But the comparisons are still useful. Spaceflight is an immersive experience that spares no traveler, while aging happens to every Earthling, whether we like it or not. As such, life in space is a good model for understanding aging as a chronic process, Bailey says. The barren other world of outer space could even reveal new ways to protect ourselves against the process of growing old. All life on our planet has evolved under Earth's gravity and conditions, so we aren't optimized for living in any other kind of environment. Space affects different cells in different ways, says Michael Roberts, interim chief scientist of the International Space Station National Laboratory. He says, it's not a single acute exposure to toxic agents, for example, it's something that's long-term, chronic and persistent. Living in space resets the body's equilibrium levels for functioning optimally, he adds, thereby rebooting the physiological norms of how cells respond. In microgravity, the heart, bones, and muscles don't need to toil as hard as they do back on Earth, so they languish from disuse. Liquids flow differently in space, and this may change the shapes of fluid-filled tissues, such as those in the brain. The higher background radiation beyond Earth's atmosphere may also damage DNA and increase the risk of cancer. Even the slightly higher carbon dioxide levels on the International Space Station ISS can throw off an astronaut's physiology. The new research on the health effects of spaceflight echoes the findings of a previous comprehensive health profiling of NASA twin astronauts Scott and Mark Kelly. The NASA twins study involved 10 research teams monitoring the molecular and physiological changes that Scott experienced during and after a year-long sojourn in space. The researchers compared the changes to Scott's identical twin, Mark, who stayed earthbound during this time. From over 300 biological samples, the teams catalogued a series of bodily differences in the twin astronauts, including changes to the astronauts' genes expressions, microbiomes, cognitive functions, and vascular systems. In the twin study, Bailey made a striking discovery. Scott's telomeres changed in length. Telomeres plug the end of chromosomes to protect them from damage, much like the plastic caps that prevent shoelaces from fraying. They are a good indicator for aging, Bailey says, because their length are affected by all aspects of earthly living, from our diet to our lifestyle and even our mental well-being. Telomeres shorten as we age, and how quickly our telomeres shorten is an important marker of health. Martin Scottsdyme in space scientists observe an unexpected overall lengthening of his telomeres. When he returned to Earth, however, his telomeres rapidly shrunk. Even though they were longer during spaceflight, he still ended up with shorter telomeres than he started with, Bailey says. Altered telomeres length has been associated with things like cardiovascular disease, particularly short telomeres, she adds. However, Scott's elongated telomeres during his time in space isn't a good sign either. Longer telomeres are also associated with cancer. You really can't win the game. As revealing as the twin study was, it only had a sample size of one. Scott Kelly measured against a control participant in his twin brother Mark. Now researchers are confirming the study's findings, including telomere changes, by examining dozens of astronauts who have spent months in space. Like in the twin study, the researchers recorded a suite of physiological changes and attempted to identify the mechanisms, such as specific proteins or genes, that cause them. Some of the symptoms of spaceflight seem to stabilize after a certain amount of time in orbit, such as decreased blood volume and changes in the heart and lungs. But astronauts haven't lived on the International Space Station ISS long enough for scientists to say for sure that these changes to the body will ultimately reach a steady state. We've now got some foundational studies, Bailey notes, but it's still a little too early to say. Space is also a fitting environment for scientists to test drug candidates associated with aging. In a recent study, one research team at pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly tested whether an antibody drug could prevent muscle loss in mice on the International Space Station ISS. The group leveraged space's biologically stressful environment to induce muscle atrophy resembling aging and cancer. According to retired Eli Lilly cellular biologist Rosamund Smith, who led the research, in space, the whole body of the animal is under the effects of microgravity. An analogous aging experiment on Earth would involve raising mice in a weightless environment by suspending their hind limbs with slings, or simply waiting for the mice to grow old. But artificial aging methods on Earth don't provide a full body experience to age all the body's muscles at once, Smith says. The Eli Lilly researchers confirmed that space indeed shrinks and weakens the muscles of the mice living on the International Space Station, matching previous observations in astronauts. Injecting the antibody drug into the mice preserved the mice's muscles. Such drugs could counter microgravity's pernicious effects on astronauts during longer crewed missions and be used as therapeutics back on Earth. It's amazing how widespread the effects of microgravity are on the human system, Smith says. There's a benefit to understanding and using space to help us learn about human physiology and therefore human disease. Scientists are also shifting to a new research platform that models human physiology better than animals, tissue chips. These USB stick-sized gadgets contain chambers and channels of cells bathed in liquid sustenance. Tissue chips typically host a concoction of cells representative of a particular human organ. Fluid flow in the chips is able to reproduce the body's inner shear and stretch forces, and a chip's interior walls provide anchor sites for cells to arrange and grow on. Essentially, tissue chips behave like a microcosm of the internal human body.
biggest concern with most Iranians at the moment is to put bread on the table and the possibility of once again planning a future. That is what they expect of the future president. It would make for their criteria for voting. Iran's to elect itself a new president and top politician in less than 2 weeks. But it appears any of the seven candidates getting in will find his main challenge to be economic rather than political. For a look into Iran's multifaceted economy, economic challenges and possible solutions, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Whatever plans the different candidates have for different economic issues would make or break them in the presidential race. Issues are inflation, poverty, unemployment, and skyrocketing prices for basic household goods. Principalists or conservatives blame problems on the Rouhani administration's looking to the West to solve the country's economic woes. The question today is, what will they, the candidates, bring to the table? Dr. Shaghoghi is Dean of Khwarazmi University's Faculty of Economy. He came to share his views with us at Press TV Studios.
Any cabinet that will take office would face these problems and challenges, which have escalated compared to the previous decade. As time passes by, the problems worsen. Another point to mention is that all the think tanks are predicting by 2030 no country would buy oil. This means an end to the oil exports era.
Dr. Raghfar is an economist teaching at Al-Zahra University, where we met him. He mentions the main reason for a high inflation rate.
The main reason behind the rise of inflation in Iran is what's called the costs push, which is mainly caused by currency manipulation. Iran's inflation has ranged somewhere about 14 to 15%, when there haven't been wide fluctuations in the value of our national currency. But in the past 8 years, the inflation in Iran averaged 24%. The highest inflation level was recorded last year at 50%. It was mainly caused by the devaluation of the national currency, as I just mentioned.
Hassan Rouhani didn't inherit a bed of roses when he started out as president in 2013. International sanctions had been tightened in 2011, and inflation was at over 30%, and there appeared no way out but to negotiate a deal with the world's economic powers. That would be the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal with the P5 plus one, the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. They would lift the UN's nuclear-related economic sanctions off this country in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. The US pulled out, however, in 2018 and made things worse for this country.
The 11th government took office with a promise to solve Iran's nuclear-related issues, lift sanctions, and improve the country's international ties. But the nuclear negotiations that were expected to be wrapped up fast took about 2 to 2.5 years to conclude. Even after JCPOA was reached, several issues, including banking relations, were left unsolved. The government put all its eggs in the basket of the nuclear deal.
Although it may not be tangible, the Rouhani government is said to have kept the economy afloat, when it could have actually drowned by U.S. sanctions, the oil revenues frozen abroad, and the COVID-19 pandemic. Not sure our Dr. Raghfar agrees.
It appears to me that we have all the resources to fund the public sector, but there isn't a political will to get that done. The fact that the government hasn't turned to taxes and that Iran's tax system is flawed and inefficient depends on how much they fit the interests of the decision makers.
Now, Iran's problem is indeed also corruption and mismanagement, not just external sanctions. Whatever weakness or malice and vice the government may have, it is not the ultimate force in the country to carry all the blame. The government needs tax revenues it cannot extract from the most powerful institutions or invisible incomes. It attempted selling bonds for public companies and enterprises, but those basically didn't land in the palms of actual private companies and investors who get the industry running and so create jobs. Dr. Hakshanos is a prominent economist who was, for his tireless capability, appointed governor of Golestan province when floods swept over the country in 2019. He joined us on Skype.
What the incumbent administration did was, instead of borrowing from the central bank and injecting stronger money into the economy, it attempted to address the budget deficit by selling treasury bills or other securities worth 200 trillion tumans. If the government didn't take this initiative, Iran's economy could sink into hyperinflation, as many experts were predicting following Donald Trump's withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018.
Plenty of solutions suggested by economists, but do any plans and ideas put forth by presidential candidates read with those solutions to economic woes? Let's hear it from an expert. Have you seen any concrete economic plans by the presidential candidates?
I haven't seen any candidate with a comprehensive plan so far. I don't know if they have a plan, but they are yet to publish their agenda through the media or on their websites. The plans have to incorporate the priorities, including those for reforms, operations, how to address major challenges, their quantifiable goals, approaches and strategies. You see, a team of doctors must have a plan that identifies the challenges facing the patient, prioritize which ones to address first, and determines the necessary treatment.
It's come to that time when any guess as to who the next president is can be second-guessed, when the expected outcome can make a U-turn. That's because electoral debates are underway. The first round was on Saturday, the 5th of June, and that was the economic round, when candidates could have recreated their destinies. Overall, the debate between the seven candidates wasn't impressive. Although the seven were to respond to predetermined questions, they basically seized the opportunity to respond to criticisms and attack one another and the outgoing Rouhani administration, or to promote their own plans.
We need to do things like levying taxes on non-productive jobs and at the same time reducing taxes on the producers.
When we carefully study the matters, we realize that the government's relationship with the economy and the economies with the people haven't been adjusted. Whenever the government faces a problem, it delves into the pockets of the people.
Dear Iranians, your economic conditions can be improved a lot, but that necessitates reforms that the other candidates can't make. But I have the plan and the ability to do so, dear people.
Unfortunately, in our country, the relevant authorities have become responsible for the protection of foreign currency instead of being responsible for protecting the value of the national currency.
Statistics show that all